uncomfortably warm, almost stifling, from the humming heat of the electronics equipment and the press of human bodies crowded together. Remote operator consoles were ringed around the perimeter of the circular chamber, each manned by a blue-uniformed man or woman in control of a robotic fighting machine. Some of the operators glanced over their shoulders at their colonel's loud confrontation with the stranger. Most stayed bent over their screens, earphones clipped over their hair, pin microphones at their lips. "It's perfectly all right," Rick said amiably. "I'm here to observe how your units conduct themselves." The colonel's irritated expression gradually eased into a sort of confused befuddlement. "Observer, eh?" he muttered darkly. "You'd think these politicians up in headquarters would know enough to send me notice aforehand. You might have gotten yourself shot by the guards." Rick, who had projected himself directly into the middle of the field command center, smiled gently. "I'm only here to see how your brigade is dealing with the terrorists." The colonel humphed. "Terrorists? They're nothing better than drug smugglers. Poppies, opium. Our orders are to cut off their route through the pass and into India." Nodding, Rick asked, "Do you conduct raids on their manufacturing operations?" "When we're allowed to," the colonel answered. "We get coordinates from the recon satellites, but before we can go after them, we have to get permission from headquarters. Most times they've folded up shop and moved elsewhere by the time we get there." For the rest of the morning, the colonel showed Rick every aspect of his command center, from the communications consoles that linked with the surveillance satellite to the remote control units for the infantry robots that did whatever actual fighting needed to be done. Warming to his task of host, the colonel even took Rick outside the dome of the command center, past the rifle-carrying guards that Rick had casually bypassed, to a larger metal prefabricated structure that housed the brigade's maintenance and repair center.
"Bloody mechanical beasties spend more time in here than out in the field," the colonel grumbled as they entered the clanging, rumbling repair shop.
Laser welders flashed. Men and women in coveralls, stained by machine oil and perspiration, seemed to be scurrying everywhere. He led Rick to one of the robotic soldiers, a blocky pile of metal that towered over them, nearly 3 meters tall. It stood on four legs that ended in round, paw-like feet. "Can these machines maneuver in the mountains out there?" he asked.
"Aye, and they can fight damned well, too. Studded with weapons they are, from anti-personnel lasers to rocket-propelled grenades."
With that, he walked to a tool bench and picked up a palm-sized controller. One click, and half a dozen weapons sprang out from recesses in the robot's bulky body. Rick instinctively flinched back a step. The colonel laughed.
"Do not be afraid, lad. It's not loaded nor powered up."
Laughing uneasily back at him, Rick said, "It's impressive, even unloaded."
"Aye," said the colonel. Then his expression sobered. "Too bad we're not allowed to use 'em properly."
"Not allowed? What do you mean?" The colonel tugged at his fierce red mustache, then answered,
"We should be going into the hills and digging out these drug plantations. Burn them out. The science boffins claim they have sprays that'll make the poppies harmless. Something genetic that'll stop the plants from producing the opium chemicals."
Surprised by the news, Rick asked, "So why don't you do that? You could end the drug trade that way."
"Orders from higher up," the colonel said darkly. "The big brass doesn't want to end the drug trade. Too much money involved, if you ask me."
"What do you mean?"
"End the war, and you'd have to disband the troops. Better to keep things simmering along, long as our casualties stay low. That way there's always a need for the peacekeepers."
Rick felt shocked. "But that's... it's wrong."
"Aye," said the colonel.
Then, his nose wrinkling with disgust, he added,
"Besides, there's always bribery, you know."
Chapter 11. The President of the United States was giving an informal address to a few hundred corporate executives assembled on the south lawn of the White House's beautifully tended grounds. The event was the highlight of the annual Christian Business Executives meeting, which had filled four of downtown Washington's biggest and grandest hotels with businessmen and women from all across the nation. This special little luncheon was only for the topmost members of the organization, however, the creme de la creme, the true movers and shakers of American business.
And although the international situation is still quite serious, the president was saying from the little podium that had been set up at the head of the rows of tables, I can say with confidence that we are clearly winning the conflicts in Latin America and Indonesia. A few more years of effort and sacrifice should see the terrorist elements driven out of those war-torn areas for good. The assembled executives rose as one organism and applauded lustily. The president smiled and nodded to the few he knew personally up in the front row. He recognized the heads of three aerospace corporations, two agribusiness combines, and a scattering of electrical utility corporations, all solid supporters of his reelection campaign. The president stepped back from the podium with its blast-proof glass-steel shields. Secret Service guards and U.S. Marines with laser handguns beneath their colorful dress uniforms formed a phalanx around him as the executives jostled one another good-naturedly to line up for photo opportunities with the president. After a seemingly endless round of posing and handshaking, the president at last ducked back inside the cool and quietly busy West Wing corridor that led to the familiar security of his Oval Office. As he stepped into the lavatory to strip off his jacket and bulletproof vest and change into a fresh shirt, the president called out, "They really liked what I had to say, didn't they?" "Of course they did," said the head of his speechwriting team. "You delivered it magnificently." Striding to his old-fashioned dark mahogany desk as he pulled on a dark blue jacket, the president cast a mock frown at his chaplain. "Reverend, I thought we agreed that your blessing wouldn't be longer than my speech." The black-garbed minister stiffened with surprise.
"But it wasn't, Mr. President."
Chuckling at him, the president said, "Almost, Reverend, almost." All the others in the Oval Office laughed politely. Even the chaplain allowed himself to chuckle softly. "All right," the president said. "What's next?" His appointments secretary answered,
"The Canadian ambassador."
The new secretary added, "Camera crews, no direct quotes." Nodding, the president asked, "Why am I seeing the Canadian ambassador?"
"About the water deal," said his chief of staff impatiently. With a hard, demanding expression on his face, he added, "And it wouldn't hurt if you let him understand that our troops will be detaching from Indonesia before the year is out."
The president looked puzzled.
"What's that got to do with Canada?"
"The army will be freed up to move north if we don't get the concessions we need."
"Oh, yeah, right."
"And you could bring up the matter of migrant workers," the chief of staff added. "There's at least 500,000 American citizens working in the Canadian wheat belt, and we want them treated properly, not like a bunch of Okies."
"Okies?"
"Migrant workers."
"But that's what they are, aren't they?"
"That's not the point," the chief of staff said, his voice edgy with impatience. "We want our people treated with respect."
"And they should be free to set up their own churches," the chaplain said.
"On Canadian soil?"
"God does not recognize national boundaries," the chaplain replied loftily.
Okay. The appointments secretary cleared her throat to get everyone's attention, then announced,
"I've had to slip in a meeting with Archbishop Overmyer at 4:30.
"The Archbishop? Here? Himself?"
"Yes. His office said it was an urgent matter."
"Probably about those damned northern lights," muttered the chief of staff.
"Yeah, what about the lights?" the president asked. "Doesn't anybody know why they're shining every night?"
The staffers glanced around at one another.
"What do the science people have to say about it?" the president asked.
Before anyone could reply, he added,
"Say, who in the world is my science advisor anyway?"
"The position of science advisor was removed from your staff," said the chief.
"You don't need a science advisor. You've got the head of the National Academy of Sciences, remember?"
The president blinked, puzzled, then brightened.
"Oh, yeah. That Jewish fellow. What's his name?"
"Feingold."
"That's right, Feingold."
"Should I call him to this meeting with the Archbishop?" asked the appointments secretary.
The president waved a hand in the air.
"No, it's not that important."
Turning back to his chaplain, he said,
The Archbishop